Hello and welcome to another edition of Positive Leadership, a podcast that helps you grow as an individual, a leader, and ultimately as a global citizen. I'm Jean-Philippe Courtois.
I believe in positivity. I believe negative energy is a blocker. Negative energy saps you. So I believe in keeping a positive energy in whatever I do. And I believe in radiating that positivity in every forum, in every meeting. Because finally, societies change only because human beings make change happen. And if you can use your position to actually impact many, many people to do better than what they were doing, that's the ultimate impact you can have.
My guest today, Nandan Nilekani, has played a central role in kickstarting India's digital transformation journey, a journey which has had a profound impact on millions of people's lives and work. After co-founding Infosys and building a global IT giant, he spent the last 13 plus years creating India's pioneering digital public infrastructure, developing open source technology to solve some of the most pressing societal problems. He led the rollout of the digital identity card, which has helped millions of Indians get their first official proof of identity, enabling them to open bank accounts, gain financial inclusion as an example. More recently, Nandan co-founding the XStep Foundation, whose goal is to reach 200 million children in India and improve their access to learning opportunities. We covered so much ground in our discussion. The power of entrepreneurship, what drives him, how to channel your purpose, and the importance of visualizing a future that's ambitious. And also what skills you need to develop in order to bring together diverse teams to achieve big, ambitious goals. This episode is really packed with useful wisdom and advice. Wherever you are in your leadership journey, I got so much out of speaking to Nandan, and I'm really excited to share our discussion with all of you now. Make sure you stay with us till the very end. You know, you and I go a long way. Think back to 2000 when I was in Davos myself. I was running a MIA at the time for Microsoft. And then, of course, I happened to run the Microsoft Global Business, and we met a number of times in that capacity. And I've been also visiting your country for the last 25 years of my life, which has been amazing always to see India reinventing itself. So we'll come back to that discussion. What an amazing ride you had with Infosys, the India tech industry, and with India as a country all up. So I'd love to unpack all of that together. But let's start at the very beginning, if you don't mind. You are born and living in Bangalore, which today is one of the epicenters of the startup world, actually. So not just in India, but globally. I was there recently, and I was struck by the big ideas and the global mindset of the entrepreneurs I met. So what was life like for you as a child to start really early on, Nandan? Grow up in Bangalore, what were your ambitions? And what values did you inherit maybe from your parents that inform your choices and decisions later on?
You know, the Bangalore I grew up in was what was then called as a pensioner's paradise. It was a retirement city, everything wrapped up by 8 in the evening or something. And so it was a very different Bangalore in which I grew up. And I grew up, my father was working in a mill. My mother was a homemaker. And I think, obviously, we valued education and we valued that. Also, both my father and later on my uncle, with whom I lived in a town called Dharwad, were very, all our conversations were about global issues, and they were not about what did you eat today, but it was about how the world can be changed or how India can be changed. And so I always, I remember when I was a child, my father took me to Lal Bagh, which is a large park in Bangalore. And Jawaharlal Nehru was in the city and he made me wave at him. So we grew up in that kind of an environment. So I always believed that I, of course, later on joined and became successful at business. But always at the back of my mind, I had this thought of doing something bigger for society.
Oh, very clear. And this kind of global mindset, not just India, but actually the world and the biggest issues you had around the world. You were accepted onto a course at the Indian Institute of Technology, Bombay, a much coveted institution, and thrive both academically and socially. You've described it as being, I think, one of the big breakthroughs in your life. So why was it such a big deal at the time?
Well, after my Bangalore stint, I was in this small town called Dharwad. And I was very, very keen to get to a place where I could really be with a fantastic peer group, where I could have ample opportunity. And in the 1973 in that year, IIT was the best place for young Indians to go. And it was like, you know, it gave you the escape velocity to get into different kinds of things. So I was very happy to go there. And it was, in some sense, the defining period of my life, because I became a mature person there. All my very good friends are still from those days. I'm still deeply connected to IIT in many ways. So what I am is because of IIT, and it shaped me not only intellectually, but also in terms of helping me build a very diverse set of interests, which made me successful in business. So I really believe that I owe a lot of my transformation and maturity to the 5-odd years I spent at IIT.
No, very interesting, because sometimes, you know, people talk about their school, university as something, of course, with some nostalgia and also some great memories. But the way you describe it seems very holistic, right? In terms of the people, the roots, the social, economic, and business opportunities as well it entails. And actually, you met some of the key people, I think, who are still surrounding you, right, in your life. And in 1981, you co-founded Infosys. And over the last 40-plus years, Infosys as a company catalyzed, I think, some of the major trends that have led to India's emergence as a global destination for software development, software services, of course. So it was interesting what you said in your purpose statement, that you wanted to create a company that would be a role model in every aspect of running a business, how to treat employees, the way it's a stakeholder in society as well, the way it practices corporate governance, and the way it's also, of course, very customer-centric. So before you have a chance, of course, to shape it into this global giant, why did you decide in the first place to join a startup, which was not necessarily obvious, right? It was a nascent company. And what role did your co-founder, Narayana Murthy, play in attracting you to the job and eventually, I understand, mentoring you as well?
Well, Narayan Murthy was the reason why Infosys happened. He was our leader. And when he told us that he would like to start a company, we didn't even have to have a moment of hesitation. We said, we'll follow you there. So I'm there in Infosys entirely because of him. And he was an amazingly charismatic and bold leader. And we were all from middle-class values. Mr. Narayan Murthy himself had been a leftist. He was in Paris for a couple of years. He worked in Paris but over time, he realized that the only way to change the world was through compassionate capitalism, that you create wealth, but then you share the wealth with employees, you have an impact on society. So all of us had that kind of idealistic mindset. So we were driven by not just creating any other company, but by creating an agent of change, something that will transform, something that will set new rules of conduct, and that will inspire others to do the same. So we did that on many aspects, whether it's the way we run the company, the way we did corporate governance, the way we handle our finances. Everything was about doing it in a way that we set a standard, set a bar. And so Infosys, in some sense, was India's original startup. Today, it's an $18 billion company with 330,000 plus employees. $60 billion in market cap and so on. So fundamentally, we set the tone for how to create a professional startup company in India and make it huge.
When Nandan and the other founders started Infosys back in the early 80s, they were all first-generation entrepreneurs and did not have a lot of money, actually. But when they discussed what their vision should be, the word they landed on was respect. If you strive for respect from customers and employees, you'll for sure treat them fairly. With investors, you have to give decent returns and make sure you're profitable. And to get respect from society, people need to see a real benefit from the company existing. There was a strong belief amongst the founders that a company has a duty to produce products and services that can improve the lives of ordinary people. And Nandan's co-founder and mentor Narayana Murthy was a very inspirational role model. He did not approve of taking lavish holidays or using private jets. He showed the average middle-class Indian that you can succeed while being ethical. And his journey over 40 years, Infosys has been incredibly successful. It was indeed the first IT company from India to be listed on NASDAQ. And its employee stock options program credits some of India's first salaried millionaires.
No, you've been obviously an amazing role model for many of your peers now who have created this pretty amazing IT tech industry in India now for many decades that we know. And Infosys, as you said, of course, scaled very quickly. Under, I think, your five-year tenure as a CEO, if I'm not mistaken, the annual growth increased by 38%. And you've talked about how you imagine what the company could be one day and then worked on what you would need to do to make that happen. So I wonder how important it is for you to be able to visualize or maybe verbalize. You know, some people are more on using words. Others are painting, drawing a picture for others to really shape the goals and kind of the mission of this company. And how do you do that? If you could share that with our listeners, that would be great.
I believe very strongly that part of the role of leaders is to visualize a future, future which is ambitious, which is audacious, and yet plausible. And then articulate that and excite and energize people towards that goal. And that's how Infosys began. But till about the early 90s, Infosys was a relatively small company. But in the 90s, India went through multiple changes. We had economic reforms. Earth stations allowed you to do remote software development. The market was liberalized and so on. And that's when we at Infosys took a big decision that we would accelerate our growth and become a major player in the IT industry. So we went public in 1993. We built India's first campus and we really invested in sales and marketing abroad and so on. And then the Infosys growth happened. But at every stage, we would define a vision of what our future state would look like. And that gave everybody the energy to move towards that. So my one lesson I've learned in life is always articulate a vision or make it ambitious, make it audacious, make it bold, but make it plausible. And that get everybody energized to go towards that goal.
So I love the way you've been using multiple times, because I'm with you, the word energy, right? And I would always add another word, Nandan, positive energy, obviously, because of course, there are different types of energy sometimes you find with people. So how do you maintain what we call in this podcast as well, a positive mindset? Basically, a mindset which shows, propagates positivity, not in a naive way, but in a way that really rallies others to work with you, to build a mission, to execute on the vision. How do you do that? And how do you maintain that energy every day? Because sometimes you have some tough days as well, right? In life and business.
I think sometimes you go through periods when you think that it's all over. But when an event happens, I analyze it and see how it impacts me. And even if it has a negative impact, I internalize it and then I move on. And I'm also always very forward-looking. So at this point, I'm not thinking about what I have done in the last 40 years. I'm thinking about what I will do in the next, 10 years or whatever. So this forward-looking thing enables me to be very positive.
No, I love that. And the way as well, as you said rightly, the way you make a post to evacuate some of the negativity that you may have from time to time, because you got your little voice talking to you and JP, Nandan, oh, this is not good what you did, da-da-da.
Yeah.
And you stop that to focus right on what you can do, right, to actually accomplish the mission. So, Nandan, since 2009, clearly India has been rolling out population-scale digital infrastructure, which is delivered at a very high volume and very low cost, free in many cases and paid in some others. And, of course, you played a leading role in doing that. One day, I think you got a call from the Prime Minister office at the time, and you decided to take a leave of absence from Infosys to join the government to roll out the world's largest and most ambitious digital ID systems called Aadhaar, which was aimed at providing each Indian resident with a unique 12-digit identification number linked to their biometric and demographic information. This was a huge, one of the most amazing social project ever done, perhaps the biggest on the planet. It marked a significant change of direction for you working for the government. What made you want to lead this mind-blowing project? You as a business executive, how could you see yourself take this call and say, I'm going to jump there, I'm going to do it?
Well, you know, I was 54 years old. I'd been, the CEO of Infosys. I was the co-chair at that time. We had built this amazing company. But as you know, I always had this desire to do something on a larger canvas, on a larger scale. Yeah. So, and I'd written a book in 2008 called Imagining India, where I talked about how an ID can help a country. And that's how I got this call from then Prime Minister Dr. Manmohan Singh to come and join the government. And then I had to ask the permission of my co-founders, because we had a simple rule that if anybody wants to leave for any reason, they have to get the permission of their co-founders. And my co-founders were very supportive. They said, you're going to the national level to do something for the country. That's our spirit. So they let me. So actually, I retired from Infosys. I retired from Infosys. I had a very nice corner office overlooking a golf course. I had thousands of employees. I had a good life. And I said, no, let me go. So I moved from Bangalore to Delhi. I moved from a company with 100,000 plus employees to employee number one of a startup in the government. I had to begin life all over again. But I felt that this was the time for me. So, and that was a very difficult 5 years for me, because I had to deal with so many objections. So that actually made me even stronger as a human being, because I could deal with adversity and setbacks and still move forward.
No, I think what's amazing in the decision you made, Nandan, it was like a one-way ticket, right? You said, you retire. You didn't say, I'm going to leave for a couple of years. It doesn't work. I'll come back as a CEO.
Yeah.
No, it worked. You were on the mission. So tell us the way you've been able, coming from a very different environment and background, you've been able to shape this incredible mission across a giant, gigantic government as well and public services in India. And also the way you've been building what I would call the dream team, right? Because finding the right people from the bureaucracy, but also, I guess, from very different backgrounds on tech and others, is super hard. So how did you manage that huge transformation?
Well, I think there were a couple of two, three parts to that, Jean-Philippe. One is that I believe in consensus building and reaching out to people.
Yeah.
So I spent a huge amount of my time in the government meeting everybody and aligning them with my vision of what is going to come. And that investment in building that one-to-one partnership was very important. Also, the other thing, as I discussed earlier, when you set a bold objective for yourself, you attract other people to come. So when this was announced that I would do this ID project, and when people saw the boldness of the vision, they came to me. I didn't even have to go out and look for them. I got very good people, both from the bureaucracy, like my colleague Ram Sevak Sharma, who was my CEO. And I got very good people from the private sector, because I had to marry the bureaucracy and the private sector capabilities to create this solution.
As you know, many enterprises have a huge challenge to build diversity in their teams, right? Well, you've been confronted with that at the crux of that issue, right? People having a very different mandate in life, serving their country, the government, and business people. How did you kind of blend them together in one team?
No, that was not, it was definitely a difficult thing, because both had their views about the other, right?
So I'm sure
the technology business guys were informal guys, first name basis, wore shorts. It was a flat infrastructure, and they thought the government guys are all into hierarchy and all that. And the government guys thought these private sector guys are only about making money. So, each had a view of the other. But what I did was I defined a goal, a very public goal, to say that before our term is over, which is in 5 years, we would issue 600 million IDs to Indians. And that was a very bold and slightly, people thought I was a bit crazy to say that goal. Yeah. They all said, don't open your mouth and make some promises like that. But for me, saying that was very important. And this became such an all-important goal for the team that they subsumed the differences to work for the big goal. So the other lesson I've learned of leadership is, if you set a big goal, then the goal is bigger than any of us. and our internal politics goes down because we all have to work together to get to the big goal.
I'd like to just pick up on a lesson from Nandan about goal setting. There's value in going after big goals beyond achieving them. And in my experience, the payoff, even when we miss by a mile, is really worth the risk. Big goals stretch what we believe is possible. And like Nandan says, they create a sense of shared purpose. One that helps your team stay focused on what truly matters. But the nuance here is in the word plausible. You want big, bold goals, audacious goals, but not crazy, unreachable ones. You need to create an environment where people feel stretched enough to go much further without thinking this is something that is never going to get done. So delivering this project to provide each Indian resident with unique 12-digit identification number linked to their biometric and demographic information was just so ambitious. So I wanted to ask Nandan about the challenges he encountered along the way.
I mean, there are two parts to this. One is, of course, the technology was extremely sophisticated because we had to do a biometric deduplication of a billion people records. And nobody had done that before. We were in uncharted territories. And let's say we had 500 million people in our database and a million people enrolled. We had to do 500 trillion matches to eliminate duplicates. So it was massively thousands of computers and all that stuff.
Yeah.
But the more difficult problem was the politics of it. How do we get everybody in the country to sign up? How do we build an enrollment? We built an enrollment system of 35,000 enrollment stations to do 1.5 million enrollments a day. But all of them had to be quality managed. So everybody had their software given by us on a desktop. And so that everything was, and very high level of telemetry. And we really had to manage a massive system with, we had only 200 people in our organization. So whereas in our ecosystem, there were, you know, a few hundred thousand people. So the only way we could manage that was with data coming from all the operations.
Yes.
And we also had to make the ID non-threatening to people. So like when we first launched it, people said, when I have a passport, why do I need this ID? Or I have a driver's license. Why do I? We said, no, this ID does is say John is John. Whether John gets a passport, you decide. Whether John gets a driver's license, somebody else decides. So once they realized that we're not trying to take away their role, they were much more supportive of our idea.
But how could you do that? How could you convince, let's say, some of the most remote farmers at the bottom of the pyramid, right? How did you convince those people that it makes sense for them to go and get an identity?
That they were the easiest to convince. The challenge was not them. Challenge was all the guys in the cities who thought they knew everything, you know. Because the farmer and others realized that this ID is an economic asset. It is something they could not fully visualize what all you could do with it.
Yes.
But they realized that the government is giving you this ID. Yep. There's bound to be some benefits out of that ID in the future. So we had no problem in convincing millions of people to enroll around the country. A challenge was really arguing with people in the decision-making.
Decision-making.
Yeah. I mean, I remember on the technical side, I was driving up to Mussoorie one day. I got a call from Srikant Nadamuni, who was at that time the CTO. And Srikant said, all the experts say this is impossible to do, that all the computers in the world are not enough to deduplicate a billion records. So, you know, so I said, oh my God, right from day one, we have a problem. But, you know, we have some very smart people who figured out how to unlock this issue. And today, you know, we're able to do all this massive deduplication with a very, comparatively a simple infrastructure. Or, you know, some people took Aadhaar to the Supreme Court and told the Supreme Court that Aadhaar is against your right to privacy. So that became the second longest case in the Indian Supreme Court.
Wow.
And finally, we won the case.
Why did you win the case, by the way? Because that was also very unlikely, probably, right?
No. Because we built it for privacy. We did not collect too much. We collected only name, address, date of birth, and sex.
We made
sure that's only used for identification. It was not collecting data about you. There was no targeting, nothing. So by design, it was designed to be designed for privacy.
Mm.
And the Supreme Court upheld that. But there are many times in that journey when we had our hearts in our mouth as to what would be the decision there. So, or I had to get money from the government. The whole project would have cost $1.5 billion or thereabouts. But every time I had to go up in the government to get the budget sanctioned, somebody else who didn't want this to happen would have, you know, come in the way kind of thing. So fundamentally, you know, you have to fight all these issues within the system, with the lawyers, with activists, with politicians. Then I had to make sure that the idea was bipartisan. So I went to every chief minister in the country and sat with them and told them why this was good for them. And so they were able to create a national consensus around the ID project.
So again, as you said before, I think, Nanda, what's kind of remarkable is the way you've been deeply personally involved, one-to-one as well, with many relationships.
Oh, yeah.
Right? I mean, across the bureaucracy, across, I'm sure, the tech industry as well, and across many other stakeholders. And you spend a lot of your time just convincing them, eyes to eyes, one-to-one, on the vision, I guess, right? One by one.
Absolutely. And I know it's all about maintaining this huge network, which is very diverse, reaching out to people, getting them to buy in, keeping the idea simple so that they understand it, convincing them about the benefits of the idea. So it's how you do anything which is a large change management.
What's amazing about that, what you've achieved, is actually how much of a low cost it is in terms of investment compared to many huge IT projects you've been working on. I've been working my life, which I've been, wow. So could you share with us some of the units of economy per transaction, whatever, and all up of how much the Indian government had to invest to achieve that?
Well, the total investment was about $1.5 billion or thereabouts. It was about $1 per person. And we built everything with an operating cost model. So these enrollment agencies were largely private companies, and they were paid only on successful IDs generated. Yes. So it became an outcome-based pricing. So we didn't pay to buy the equipment. So they bought the equipment and they had to use it efficiently to make money out of it. So that's why they would go out and enroll all over the country. And our backend would make sure that a person got only one ID. So they couldn't game the system from the front end because at the back end, if they enrolled the same person three times, only one would succeed. So it's not worth it for them to do that. So architecturally, we put simplicity at the front end, complexity at the back end, designed it to enroll and created a set of incentives so that 35,000 enrollment agents could be out there doing enrollment every day. And they could only make money if they did 50 enrollments per day.
Yeah, I think what's quite incredible in your project, Nandan, is again this ability to have this huge return on what we call social innovation. Because given the cost investment you've made, for our listeners, I mean, they may not realize, compared to many governments in the world spending billions every year on IT, or projects that have never achieved anything of that scale, that's pretty amazing. And the other thing I would say is the way you've been also building a hybrid economic model, right? It's not just public money. You've been also inviting the commercial business, I would say, world to join forces. And then we'll discuss in a few minutes, actually, also the entrepreneurship model that you've been able to foster based on that.
Yes, one thing on the cost thing, JP. The total cost would have been $1.5 billion, or maybe now it may be $2 billion.
But
the government has saved $27 billion in making the delivery of cash benefits more efficient. So it's paid for itself.
Huge, huge. Excellent point, because something many people don't realize about the cost avoided and how much is achieved through technology. I like to go and expand a bit more beyond India and Nandan, which we discussed a bit together before. The digital identity solution introduced by Aadhaar again proved to be a turning point in the history of India. And unlike social security numbers and other national IDs issued by foreign countries, the Indian government built Aadhaar in a way that it could be easily leveraged and extended by developers. So you did not define a mission to be only a digital ID system, but you envision it as a technology platform with extensibility that eventually became the so-called India Stack and the DPI we'll discuss. So there are a set of layered capabilities such as payment, commerce, data, and more, that have been built over the last, I think, 15 years now, right?
That's
and
right.
Each of which is at population scale, at very low cost, accessible on your fingertips, on your phone, and all interoperating with each other. And I know you often compare the Indian stack to the internet, right, or GPS. And you said in your book, Imagine India, that the idea for it came to you back in 2010. So can you walk us through what this DPI, Digital Public Infrastructure, is all about? And how you've been able to build a public infrastructure that has also enabled an incredible startup ecosystem, build some amazing innovation we just started discussing together, and eventually had a huge impact on India's society and economy.
Thank you, JP. If you look back in 2009, when I started the project, we were inspired by two major investments. One was the internet, one was GPS. Both these were actually funded by the Department of Defense in the US. But later on, they were allowed for private innovation. And they all had layered APIs. So you had HTML and HTTP and SMTP for email and all that. And that led to the rise of Explorer and Hotmail and Google and so on.
Right.
And similarly, GPS answered the question, where am I? And using GPS, then you could have maps, then you could have Uber. So we said we should build this also like that, where the ID is answering the question, who am I, through a standard API.
Yep.
And make that API available to qualified companies to use in their own application. And also use it to do what's called as know your customer, which is a prerequisite to get a bank account or get a mobile connection.
Yep.
So this authentication plus KYC opened up to private innovation was part of the original design.
What Nandan says there is so, so powerful. I love the fact he's pointing to this model of public innovation, opening a platform and some protocols for the IT industry and others to jump in and create a viable business model. It is so transformational. A few months back, at the India Global Forum, the Indian Minister of IT, Rajiv Chandrasekhar, said that the India stack today represents an enormous opportunity for global South countries to rapidly climb up the ladder of digitalization. But these countries are so different in their economic, social, political models across Asia, across Africa, across Latin America. So can they really replicate the model that Nandan has built in India? What would he do to digitize the global South?
It does not cost that much money, but it requires more than deep pockets. It needs deep conviction that you can make it happen. And I think all the technical issues have been sorted out. We have made it work at that scale, so any country can adopt it. So I would really create a huge global movement around it. I would use the pulpit of the job to get all the countries and the leaders excited about DPI. And I would come out with an implementation plan to take it everywhere. By the way, already now, we are talking to the UN. I recently, the Deputy Secretary General, Amina Mohammed, came to Bangalore. I met with her. World Bank, Ajay Banga is very keen. IMF, Kristalina Georgieva. So I think now we have global leadership around the world thinking about it. And that's why we are confident that we will be able to have at least 50 countries in the next 5 years implement one or more of the digital public infrastructure that is there.
You also have to work, of course, bottom up, right? And so working at a country level, what would be your advice for any listener? Maybe we have some government leaders, business leaders listening to this podcast as well, who want to take a shot at that in their countries. What are the key criteria of success that would be needed for any given country to make it happen?
I think ultimately all this happens with both top-down and bottom-up. I agree with you completely. So I think, first of all, there has to be a belief that digital public infrastructure can make a difference, that it can lead to better economic growth, more equitable growth, that it can lead to better revenues, better expense management. I mean, people have to believe that it's possible. And I think then they need to have the political will to get a group of people who don't work in any specific ministry, but work directly, perhaps at the head of the government level, to put in place a plan. And then piece by piece, layer by layer, they can build it with an ID or payments or whatever they want. And there's no particular sequence. You can do any sequence that you want. And I think each thing should bring tangible material benefits to the people, because that gives you the political momentum to do more of this. So I think there is a playbook that is there, and we can easily take the model we have done so far and take that playbook global.
Yeah, I love that. But can you expand just a little bit on the entrepreneurship part of the model? Because we didn't discuss much of that together. And was in India again a couple of months ago, I met with some amazing startups that have built on top of Adar a number of very innovative social, but also commercial opportunities for all cities in India. So can you develop a little bit that?
So I think it goes back to our model of looking at internet and GPS, both of which had APIs and protocols that allowed huge private companies to come up. So this Aadhaar KYC essentially enabled bank account opening very quickly. And Prime Minister Modi, when he came to power, launched a financial inclusion program called Jan Dhan Yojana. And India went from 20% bank account penetration to 80% bank account penetration in 9 years. And there's a dramatic thing. Yeah. But they could do it because you could do Aadhaar KYC and open a bank account in 1 minute electronically on the... The same thing happened with mobile firms. And when Jio was launched, Jio used Aadhaar eKYC to get 1 million customers a day and got to 100 million customers in 6 months. So that's a good example of a private company entering the mobile revolution and setting up a brand new 4G network and using the power of DPI to build a very large business. Or what happened in the payments area, companies like PhonePe and Paytm have come up, all of whom use the UPI infrastructure. So these are all multi-billion dollar value companies that have come up, but essentially they're built on top of this infrastructure. So private innovation, competition is a big part of the story.
No, it's a wonderful example again, as you peel the onion together on Nanda and to add up to the retail investment, right? We talk about, I think you said 27 billions, right? Of efficiency savings for the government of India because of Aadhaar. But if you are to add on top of that, all the economic value created by all those startups that build on the APIs for payments, for all the rest, it may be, I don't know, the number would be, maybe you've done the business case, I'm sure, all up, but it must be gigantic, right, in terms of economic
value. No, I think so. I don't know exactly what it is, but certainly runs into tens of billions of dollars. Yeah.
So, Nanda, I'd like now to shift gears and talk about your amazing leadership journey. We discussed a little bit of that, but I want to come back. So, I was just wondering, as you took on those leadership roles for Infosys and then for the Indian governments, did you have a chance actually to reflect and write down your personal mission, your personal purpose as a leader? And would you mind sharing it with us and how you made it resonate again with the mission of two huge organizations like Infosys and the Indian government itself? So your purpose and the way you connected that to the bigger mission of Infosys, the bigger mission of the Indian government.
Well, my personal purpose is to have the biggest positive impact possible in my lifetime. Because of that, I have very clear priorities of how I spend my time. I don't do too many things. I do a few big things, which over time deliver a lot of impact.
Love that clarity and the way you've been actually wiring that as well into the organization you've been leading, of course, for many years. So back in 2015, you founded X-Step Foundation with your wife and Shankar Marua, I think as well, with the goal of improving literacy and numeracy by enhancing access to learning opportunities for 200 million children across India. A goal this audacious needed, of course, an equally audacious solution to build a solution for scale, one with the potential to reach, I think, 200 million students, 10 million teachers covering more than 20 languages and more than 60 educational boards. And to reach this goal, you had to find a way to enhance and amplify the efforts of educators by making high-quality resources accessible and cultivating a space where they can connect with and learn from one another. In a way, you had to find another way to restore the agency of all within the education system by solving it with the platform way, as a platform as well. So can you walk us through the aims of your foundation, how you see X-Step helping make a breakthrough for education in India And what is your boldest goal again? Because you've got bold, audacious goals for that foundation.
Well, you know, I think our goal was how do we educate 200 million children? And our first step was how do we make sure they have access? And so we created a digital public infrastructure called Sunbird. And that was used by the government in the Diksha program. So millions of teachers have access to the latest teaching content, the latest quizzing, the students have it. So all that has been rolled out. But now we are very excited by the possibilities of AI and generative AI and so on. And we think that we now probably have the tools by which learning outcomes can also improve.
I love to actually, again, double click on that. And you and I, you know, kind of the same generation. We've been living through the last three tech inflection points, right, over the life, which has been amazing. 1983 with the birth of the personal computer and Windows coming, of course, on top of that. Then clearly as well, we got later in 2007, the launch of the smartphone couple, the beginning of the cloud as well, coming together. And now late in 2022 is ChatGPT launch. We've witnessed actually the fastest adoption ever for the first 100 million users in the world in 2 months. So where do you see the biggest potential generative AI innovation for your foundation? And I would say as well for India all up.
Well, I'm very positive and bullish about what we can do with ChatGPT and other. For example, one area which we are very deeply focused on is how to have every child should have a very empathetic AI tutor. Hmm. Somebody who can sit with them, yep, does not make judgment about them. In the privacy of the app, they can learn better, yeah, to speak or to do math or whatever. So there's a whole learning part. Another thing which you know, Satya Nadella has demonstrated is an app which called Jugalbandi, yeah, where it uses ChatGPT. It has all the information for the farmer, which is ingested.
Yep.
It uses a language AI we have built in IIT Madras called AI for Bharat. So a farmer can ask a question in Hindi on some information on farming,
yeah,
that gets translated into English. It goes and hits the ChatGPT, yep, gets the answer. Answer, yep, is then converted back to Hindi, and the computer speaks to him. And suddenly the knowledge of the world has been made consumable and palatable to that person.
Yeah.
Even if he's not literate, does not operate a keyboard. So I'm actually very, very passionate about it.
No, and I do see the same, obviously, as you know, in our company as well, Microsoft, with Jugalbandi was a wonderful kind of a showcase, use case of scenarios that could be replicated across the world as well. By the way, it connects back to our discussion, I think, on the stack, right? And DPI, that should, right, be part of the DPI end-to-end, yeah, platform for the world. So it's very exciting. And I know these days, you know, and we should as well, many people are worried, anxious about the bad side, potential bad side of AI. But I think we should be so energized about the way it could be used for good purpose and good, yeah, outcomes in the world. So fantastic.
Yeah, I'm totally of the view that we have to obviously put in place the appropriate guardrails.
Yes.
On this technology, because it can be very powerful. But we should not hesitate to apply it in a good way with the safeguards, make it a responsible AI, put the safeguards, but make it useful to really change the lives of billions of people.
100% with you. So to finish with, Nandan, I'd like to pick your mind and wisdom as a coach. And I think you've been a coach along your life of many people that have been lucky to meet with you, either through your foundation, the government, Infosys, entrepreneurs, and many others. If you were mentoring a young graduate from the Indian Institute of Technology, Bombay, graduating today, what would you advise her or him to do?
Well, first of all, I would say that they're very, very lucky because they're coming of age at the most exciting time ever. I mean, you and I have been in this business for, yeah, 40 years.
Yeah.
But I'm even more excited today by the possibilities than I was 40 years back. So I think they're very lucky to be starting at that young age. And we are all fortunate to be in technology. Technology is the instrument of change. It is the multiplier of change. It has high impact. And I would recommend that they use their privileged position, mm-hmm, in life to make a difference, either by building a great business or by solving a great social problem and doing something meaningful for the rest of their lives.
I love what Nandan says there. I'm also deeply involved in positive impact entrepreneurship, which I believe is a big direction for any startup or any enterprise in the world. Nandan is such a unique blend of a thinker and a doer at the same time. His work in the private sector and the public sector at scale and his passion for advancing the lives of others come through so strongly in our discussion. And his passion and energy is something that is really contagious. As a leader, he's been amazing at bringing together large and diverse teams, working with politicians, technical teams as well, getting them on board and aligning them to the bigger mission. So given his unique leadership journey and skills, I wonder what he would like his legacy to be.
I guess the legacy is that I never stop trying to make a difference. I get up every day saying, what else can I do to make the world a better place?
You've been listening to the Positive Leadership Podcast with me, Jean-Philippe Courtois. If you'd like more great tips to help you grow as an individual, leader, and ultimately as a global citizen, head over to my LinkedIn page to subscribe to my newsletter, Positive Leadership and You. And if you've enjoyed this episode, then please do leave a comment or rating and share it with your friends. In the next episode, I will be speaking to Rita Roy, President and CEO of the Mastercard Foundation, one of the largest private foundations in the world, about her leadership journey and her positive impact. I hope you can all join us. Goodbye.